Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Udi.
Good morning, Dylan.
Well, delighted to have Udi back, and he's going to continue his talk about Jewish nationalism. And last time we left where progress was being made in the New World, mainly from people from the Old World.
Exactly. And as we'll continue, we'll see how Zionism evolved and other territorialistic movements in the Jewish world. A very interesting man, Joan. Maybe you heard of him, named Herzl.
What Jewish person hasn't?
So this Herzl guy, he's waking up in Austria. He's a news correspondent. And he's going around Europe, one day in Austria, one day in France, one day in Germany, one day in Holland, all over the place.
And multilingual.
He's multilingual, and he's also a free man of the world. You know, Jews always seen themselves as cosmopolitans. I'm not Jewish. I'm not German. I'm not this. I'm a citizen of the world. Now, you can know if somebody's Jewish if he says he's a citizen of the world. No other person will say he's a citizen of the world. Other people will be Germans or something else. In any case, this Herzl, in one of his times outside his hometown, he reaches Paris, he reaches France in the time of the Dreyfus Affair.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreyfus Affair, to refresh in the memory of those who remember, we have a soldier, Jewish officer in the French army, being accused of treason, giving secrets to the enemy. And even though it is very clear it's a forgery, meaning the evidence in the trial were not right, he's being sentenced as guilty and he's being sent to the island, to the Devil's Island, to live in exile. The Dreyfus Affair divided the French society into two parts, the Dreyfusers and the anti-Dreyfusers. We all know about Émile Zola, a very famous French author and French writer and news writer and intellectual poet that wrote the famous article blaming everybody in the French society, blaming the legal system, blaming the army, blaming so many people of blunt anti-Semitism, of actually taking Dreyfus even though he didn't do anything. And
scapegoating.
Scapegoating completely. And you can see others like Drummond, an anti-Semitic author, writing other things and accusing Zola of defending Jewish global elders of Zion trying to occupy the country. And the French society was divided, but the streets belonged to the anti-Semitics. The streets were against Dreyfus in huge numbers. Maybe the majority weren't believing in that, but they weren't going to the streets to defend Dreyfus. When there was a public ceremony taking off out Dreyfus ranks from his uniform. The crowds were cheering death to the Jews all around France, all around Paris, in front of the palace. Now, France is important here because this is the first country that emancipated the Jews.
Napoleon,
our friend, right? Mm. The French people have claimed that everybody are Frenchmen. There's no divisions in the French society. And suddenly, the Dreyfus Affair shows all the divisions in the most
blatant way.
Exactly. Herzl was horrified. He said, if it happens in France, it can happen everywhere else. The Frenchmen, you know, with their high society, with their culture, with their cuisine,
fraternity, equality.
And they are anti-Semitic. Mm. What will happen elsewhere? And he understand that there need to be a different solution. Now, he thinks in the beginning of all sorts of pretty whacked solutions. Very wild. Things that are not inside the mainstream of Judaism. For example, mass conversion. Not to become Christians, but just to say, we'll do this, and then we'll continue to do whatever we want. We'll be seculars, you know, citizens of the world. Mm-hmm. But that will ease those who think we are against Jesus or something like that. Ideas about all sorts of ideas. But then he becomes a Zionist. He reads books, he sees stories, he sees people. You know, by the time Herzl understands Zionism, we already have the Biluim. The Biluim, a small group of, we're talking 14, 15 people, tiny group, moved to Israel, tried to establish socialist Russia, mostly, but not only, also from other places. We have Mikve Yisrael, which is Allianz, attempt to establish agriculture society, Jewish agriculture society in Israel. They are not Zionist. They are not pro-nationalism. But they are definitely trying to do something in Israel. We have all sorts of ideas and concepts around. But Herzl...
About what year was this?
Beginning of the 20th century. Okay, we're talking about the beginning of the 20th century. Now, Herzl, in his amazing abilities, managed by the 20th century and during the first decades to establish a union. Now, again, Joan, we're not going to details. Everybody can open a history book to see the dates and the numbers. But what is important here is to understand that Herzl, you know, there's a question, is history made by individuals or by movements? And Herzl was both. He was an individual that started a movement or that enaglimated the movement into becoming, taking people from all over the world. You know, the first Zionist Congress had first time representative from almost every Jewish community, has people from the local administration, non-Jews that are coming to see it. It has rabbis. It has...
And this is without the internet.
And this is without the internet, without airplanes, without, you know, facsimiles, phone calls, nothing. Very hard work. Very, very much hard work. Many people opposed Herzl. You know, rabbis from both the Orthodox side and the Reform side opposed him. Seculars, Christians, people opposed him. But, you know, if so many people oppose you, it means you do something right. So in the first Zionist Congress, you know, this is when the big things happened. Mm-hmm. They established a Jewish National Fund to acquire lands. They established educational ideas. They established agriculture ideas. They established the concept of a union between different Jewish communities, which is until today. The World Zionist Organization exists until today, connecting everybody. So we are now on the verge of a movement with a goal. But, as you know, what happens when Jews are in a movement with a goal?
Different ways of getting there.
Exactly. There are different ways of getting there.
Because I was just going to say, how did he amalgamate them to work together?
Oh, no. You know, in a first AGM, everybody always agree. They're excited. By the second AGM... you have 20 splinter organizations and everybody hates each other. You have factions within the organizations, accusations about corruption, and all sorts of things in every organization. But in specifically here, there were two trends. One was Zionism, getting all the Jews to Zion, the land of Israel. Second was territorialistic. That means we need a territory. Somewhere. It could be West Australia, which was offered to the Jews.
It could be Uganda.
Uganda, which was offered to the Jews. It could be Chile. It could be Alaska. It could be Tasmania. It could be Turkmenistan. It could be a million and one places, Sinai, whatever. Over 200 places offered.
Were offered.
Offered, you know, what is it?
Dubai.
Yeah, but some people... think offered was already sealed. Something that was offered could be an idea of one mayor somewhere in, you know, South France, want Jews to come to his place. It doesn't mean it was authorized by anybody else. Okay, so it's not what we can see as a serious offer, dozens. Okay, and Jews can acquire money. It's unbelievable. Land with money. So it's a very different time from today. Today, even if I'll buy many areas in New Zealand, mm-hmm. they can't establish my own country. It's not the case in the beginning of the 20th century when people can acquire land. In any case, Joan, we can see that those two movements are trying to win. The Uganda plan that you mentioned, an offer by the British Crown to give Uganda to the Jews, was rejected by the majority but accepted by Herzl and his party. Okay? But we have a lot of people in the World Zionist Organization that go out and establish a territorial organization seeking a territory for the Jews, trying to convince different governments of giving us a territory somewhere. They did not succeed. Why did it not succeed? And actually, the answer of their lack of succession lies with the success of Zionism. You know, Zionism is a form of Jewish nationalism. It's not the only form, but it's one form. Zionism is also a form of religiosity. Zionism is also a form of socialism. It's also a form of secularism. And it's also a form of orthodoxy or liberalism. It's everything. When something is so broad,
All encompassing,
then everybody can join. And also, everybody can claim they are the flag bearers. They are the light before the camp. And you can see different groups arrive to Israel. Now, in the beginning, majority of the people are not arriving to Israel. They arrive to the New World. But they arrive to the New World and they support Zionism, which is very interesting. The millions that reach North America, the million, a bit more, that reach South America, they reach those countries, but they are also saying, we want a nation in Israel. They support it, not for themselves, but for the cousin, brother, niece that stayed in East Europe or in North Africa or in other places and can't acquire equal rights. They want a land because everybody else has a land. Now,
so they're prepared to be out of the Israel, but supporting it with their finances and their support,
exactly.
Which is as important.
Which is as important in the time being, definitely. More than that, there's another thing that happens in Israel that contribute to the success of Zionism, and that is the British occupation. World War II finishes. World War One finished with a British occupation over the land of Israel. The British, in the beginning, definitely not in the end, in the beginning thought it's a good idea to have a Jewish homeland in Israel. Not because they were philo-Semitics. Not because they suddenly converted to Judaism or because they wanted to give us a state, but because there was nobody else to talk to in the region and because it wasn't clear if the Arabs would continue to listen to the Sultan in Istanbul, to the Turks. Okay, so they want somebody to listen to them. And also because the Jews were very convincing in their argument.
So it was really the Turks that were part of the Turkish Empire.
Before the British came. Yes.
Yeah.
It was a part of the Turkish Empire, definitely. Yes.
And because the Turks backed the wrong side, they lost it.
Well, why the Turks lost the war is a whole different discussion. We can go into that. But I will say that the Turks didn't care about Zionism. Mm-hmm. They weren't pro, but they weren't anti. Israel wasn't a country. It wasn't a state. It wasn't even a province. It was divided into about three provinces. It was a very remote province in the end of the empire. It wasn't a center. Not Muslim, not Christian, not Jewish, not secular, not religious, not political, not anything. It was a place. It was divided. As more interested the Jews became in Israel, the more expensive the land became, naturally. That's every market.
Which was mainly owned by the Turkish landlords.
Exactly. Now, the Jews didn't want to come back to Israel because of the national idea. They wanted to come back to Israel because all over the world, new countries were established. Old countries were reestablished, as we spoke last week.
Right.
And they wanted their own land.
And that was a good time to do it.
It was the only time to do it. They wanted a heritage. And they came back to Israel thinking that they were the natives in Israel. They were exiled from Israel by the Babylonians, the Romans, and all sorts of factors throughout history. And now the natives are coming back.
Well, this is where their ancestors were.
Exactly. But still, the majority are not coming back. Not even when the Zionists win over the territorialists. The majority are not coming back for a couple of reasons. First, the British, at the beginning, wanted the Jews very, very fast. If you've seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, choose a different side. And they choose
oil.
Oil. Exactly. And numbers. There are much more Arabs than Jews.
In the surrounding countries.
Exactly. And they reduce the quotas for Jewish immigration to Israel. Other Jews immigrate illegally. Those by foot from the Middle East and those by ship from Europe or the New World. But the majority cannot reach Israel. Not only that, but the financial establishment in Israel cannot sustain 1 million people. It's not a third world country. I would say it's a stone age country when the British enter. There are exceptions. There's the railroad and there are places with lights, you know, after the night. But in general, the economy of the country, underdeveloped will be a huge compliment. The Turks went out of their way so the people won't acquire good status because then they would want to rebel, you know, as every empire. At any case, the British don't want to bring the Jews in. So Jews are forced to either remain in their places or come to the New World, as most of them do. In the same time, parallel to all of this, something remarkable is happening. In the West, those Jews that beforehand did not want to be a part of the nation, those ones who said, I'm a German with a Jewish faith, I'm an American with a Jewish faith, or even said, I'm a Frenchman, full stop, I don't have a faith, I'm a secular, right? I'm a Frenchman, that's it. Suddenly, big parts of them are also become supportive. I wouldn't say they are Zionist. They are definitely not Zionist. But they become supportive of the Zionists because they understand that even if they don't see themselves as a part of the Jewish nation, many people outside see themselves as a part of the Jewish nation. And moreover, even if for themselves they've decided to not be a part of that, they still have brethren that they need to look after. And that's a big shift in history. Because in the beginning, when Jewish nationalism emerged, when those saloons and cafes we talked about last week emerged all across Europe, the other people didn't care about it. They said that, you know, it's ridiculous fringe. By the time, the middle of the 20th century, you know, before World War II, in 39, and throughout the 40s, the majority of the people are supporting Zionism. If not by ideology, then by their pocket. And that is significant. In North Africa and in the Middle East and in India, the Sephardic and the Asian communities, Jewish communities, did not need to be persuaded. You know, there's a saying that they were born Zionists. But Sephardim are born Zionist. Ashkenazim, you need to convince. But Sephardim, they are born Zionist, which is very much true. Because even when they left many parts of the religion and became more secular in those countries, they still remained a part of their people, a part of Am Yisrael. And they've seen Zionism as just another step of Am Yisrael, another process. Mm-hmm. Am Yisrael was first this, then Am Yisrael was that, and now Am Yisrael is going back home. So we see all across the spectrum people that are coming back to Israel. If by foot, and as I said, majority not by foot, in their mindset. Now, what happened in 1948? We know Israel was established. We all know that. But if we're looking on the global historical picture of Jewish nationalism, you would imagine that what will happen is that all Jews that are part of the Jewish nation will do what?
Go
to Israel. Because they are a part of the Jewish nation. Now there's a free nation. So they can go. But actually, it's not what's happening, and for a good reason. We today, in the 21st century, think about nationalism as something that is localized. Meaning, if you are part of the New Zealand nation, it is because you live in New Zealand, or it's because you support the New Zealand state, country, whatever. However, in the 20th century, at least until the 80s and 90s, nationalism is a tool, is a vessel to acquire rights as a minority. Meaning, if you don't have a country you can look for, you can say, this is my country, then in your home country, which is not your nation country, you won't have rights. I'll give it an example. If a Jew lives in Damascus, and there's a blood libel, which happened in the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, I'm
sorry.
There's no protection. The people that helped them were Americans and British, because those Jewish communities tried to influence those countries, and they succeeded. But that's, you know, depends on
not
the politics.
Reliable.
It's not reliable. Exactly. Mm. If you have a country, that country can do anything in its power to protect you. Anything. You can have equal rights, because otherwise the country could influence. Now today, the power of countries decreased considerably. So today it looks ridiculous, because what could Israel do if there's a law passed against Jews in Venezuela, like something that actually happened a few years ago? There was many anti-Semitic laws in Venezuela, forbid Jews for all sorts of jobs and taking Jews out of schools and so on. That was just, you know, in the 2000, and I forgot the exact year, but it was just recently. Israel couldn't do too much. You know, you can have diplomatic measures, but that's But that's today, that's the 21st century. We live in a post-national world when individuals, NGOs, societies has more power, companies has more power than governments. That wasn't the case in the 19th and the 20th century. The Jews are a part of a nation, and they want an independent state, not only to acquire a statehood and sovereignty, but to acquire equal rights in their home countries. And this is an amazing part, that the establishment of Israel not only set free and released and gave freedom to the Jews in Israel, but actually maintained, rather than what people think, which is threatened the diaspora, maintained the equal rights of the diaspora.
Because they could influence the governments of the diaspora.
Exactly.
And there was also a place to go.
Exactly. There's an alternative. And there's a diplomatic measures. And there are a lot of things that Israel can do on behalf of the Jewish people.
I think part of the reason people wanted to go in the beginning was also political, because of a free, equal society, which everybody was egalitarian, which wasn't the place where they came from.
Oh, definitely. We haven't talked about Israel at all today. The history of Zionism and Jewish nationalism and the history of Israel are two different histories. They are very much intertwined, but they are very different.
So that's for a future
show. Not for today. We don't have time.
So you were talking about the influence that companies have and NGOs and so on. What sort of NGOs or what companies do you see as having influence? Is it financial or is
financially? Today, you know, a company like Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Coca-Cola will have more influence than the Israeli government. Today, an international organization, it could not be Jewish, whatever, will have more influence than a country, whether it's Israel or whether it's another country. Israel as a country can defend people in times of need. You know, when the Ethiopian had a civil war and hundreds of thousands of Jews' lives were in jeopardy, they paid hundreds of millions of dollars to the Ethiopian government, to the dictatorship, in order to purchase Jewish lives. And they got Jews out of Egypt, of Ethiopia, and on planes.
It was like Egypt again.
It was exactly like that, but that was a very different society. Similar thing happened in Russia. When Jews went out of Russia, Israel was a huge power getting the Jews' rights to leave Russia or Soviet Union, rather, if they wanted to. Now, what happened when the wall fell down is not that all those Jews moved to Israel. Yes, about 1.3 million moved to Israel, but another million moved elsewhere. But their ability to move elsewhere was because of Israel.
Yeah.
This is not the case today. Today, when what happened in Venezuela occurred, Israel said something and that's it. Israel has very limited political power. However, could you imagine what would happen if companies will threaten to boycott a country because they are racist or anti-Semitic? Mm. That will change the policy very fast. Now, it doesn't happen today, at least not towards the Jews, because we are in a very different point of time in general in Jewish history. But you can definitely see it with other national minorities that it doesn't occur because of the governments. It happens because of their
economic power
and civil power as a civil society.
Well, thank you very much, Udi. I look forward to the next installment of the history of the Jewish people. And thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen to Radio Shalom next Sunday at 10 past 10. So when? 10 past 10. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom.